This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Every few years, a major incident of police brutality in American cities leads people to ask, how did it come to this? The relationship between police and the communities they serve has depended a lot on wealth, privilege, and geography. And all of those factors change over time. Yesterday, we brought you an archival interview on the history of policing in Milwaukee. But now we'll discuss some of the through lines from the past to our current moment in America with Gary Potter, one of the leading experts on police history in the nation. Lake Effect's Julian Haida spoke with Potter. Lake Effect's Julian Haida spoke with Potter, who is Professor Emeritus at Eastern Kentucky University. He starts by asking what forms early policing took in a place like Milwaukee.
It emanates from the slave patrols in the South, in which essentially vigilantes with badges, and they did have badges, would seek out and return runaway slaves. You have to remember that even in free states, the law then required that runaway slaves be turned over and returned as property. They also maintained discipline on plantations, and they served as a deterrent, a pretty violent deterrent to any possibility of slave revolts. At the same time, in the North, we had private policing in the form of the coal and iron police, the railroad police. So what happened in the middle of the 1800s, was that private function, which had to be paid for by corporations, by slave owners, shifted to the public. So they made us pick up the bill for their problems. There wasn't really a crime problem. Enforcement was primarily directed at runaway slaves, Irish and Italian immigrants, and the protection of mercantilism, the protection of stores and factories and things like that. The police have never really been involved in controlling crime. As time went on, those municipal police departments continued in that historical role. In the late 1800s, they were involved in union busting and trying to prevent the formation of labor unions, arresting union organizers. If you look at police records from that time, you'll find all kinds of people arrested for the crime of loitering. Those were either unemployed people or union organizers who were moving from town to town and had no legitimate job. Therefore, they were guilty of loitering. By the time we got to the 20th century, of course, things got a little more complicated. We had prohibition, and that brought with it massive, pervasive, uninterrupted police corruption in every city in the United States. That relationship with organized crime continued and continues in large measure to today in the drug trade. We had highly politicized policing. In the 1920s, the Wickersham Commission investigated all of that, determined that policing was massively corrupt, and recommended reforms, and that began a kind of period of attempting to professionalize the police to try to separate them from political control. It wasn't until really the Nixon administration that we began to federally fund policing in the United States. They began recruitment programs under LEAA to recruit police officers. They began to give federal money to police officers for military style weapons. They began to pay for various kinds of enforcement programs, which didn't make anything better. It actually made everything worse.
Why might that be, would you say?
Well, because if you are getting money from the federal block grants and federal programs based on weight of drugs confiscated or numbers of arrests or specific federal programs, you have to have numbers to create the impetus for the funding. So if you're a police department, and just take drug arrests as an example, and the federal government is funding you because of your efficacy with regards to drugs, you're going to enforce the law against those easiest to catch, against those easiest cases. We know in every major city in the United States that the vast majority of drugs are sold in wealthy upscale neighborhoods, not in urban ghettos. The difference is that they're sold by what we call discreet drug dealers who are never caught by the police, who are never even interfered with by the police. On the other hand, the guy on the corner walking around saying, you know, you want an eight ball? That's pretty easy to make an arrest for. And that's in a large part why so much police attention, so much disproportionate police attention was directed to poor neighborhoods by federal
and government. Combined with racial segregation, I imagine it's very easy to pick that neighborhood on a map.
It is. And you know, one of the recent inventions has been crime mapping, which essentially tells us not where crime is, but where the police are and what they're doing and what kind of crimes they're enforcing the law against. If you had heavy, intense police presence in a upper class white middle class neighborhood, you would have a great deal of political resistance to that, and it would stop. There's no political resistance to policing poor neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and it certainly points to some of the inequality that people are talking about. If you're just joining us, you're listening to WUWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect. I'm Julian Haida, and with me is Gary Potter, Professor Emeritus of the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. He's the author of many books, and he studied the history of policing in America. Now, earlier you mentioned the role of the Italians, the Irish, here in Milwaukee, there's a lot of German names that are on historical police rosters. What role did ethnic white immigrants have in creating the kind of police departments that we have today with regards to where resources are spent, where patrols happen, and so on?
Well, those neighborhoods, those ethnic neighborhoods in the 1800s, were generally regarded as crime hotspots. And each particular ethnic group had its own particular version of criminality attached to it. Jewish neighborhoods were identified with prostitution. African-American neighborhoods were identified with drugs. Italian neighborhoods with organized crime. Irish neighborhoods with alcohol, crime, and gambling. But as some of those ethnic groups began to integrate more fully into society, the path out from crime and poverty was politics. And for politics, it was a short jump into policing.
And was that extended to black communities as well, or did that happen after the civil rights movement?
I don't think it's ever happened.
Oh, what do you mean by that? Because a lot of police chiefs across the country are black. Mayors make a point of appointing racial minorities to high positions in police departments. But you say that kind of capture that happened with ethnic whites 100 years ago didn't really happen necessarily with the kind of minorities that are protesting police today.
There's a great deal of symbolism and how the public face of policing in some areas is constructed today. But when you get right down to the street level, there's been very little change. There are African-American cops, no question about that. But they have to integrate into that police system. And if they try to bring the cultural values of a different community into that police system, they are resisted and resisted rather forcefully.
Now, something you mentioned earlier, kind of the early days of policing, private policing in the United States, about protecting property. How much of how we currently understand policing is still part of that? I know we understand things as law enforcement, of course, police departments, you know, they're not necessarily, you know, writing the laws that they're enforcing, but they can prioritize laws that are enforced. So when it comes to, for example, discussions about, you know, loss of property, businesses being broken into or burned to the ground, and police priorities in America today, how much of that is related to a priority of protecting private property?
Well, the police primarily are there to protect business property first and residential property second, not human interactions in any way. If that were the case, they would fail miserably. So it has always been the case that police departments will prioritize, and city governments will pass new ordinances and new laws to help them prioritize the protection of businesses and various kinds of development. One of the things that really antagonizes communities and raises the level of police violence in communities today.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about, civil disobedience and how police have reacted to it generally in the history of American policing. I remember just a couple of years ago, it was the 50th anniversary of a lot of unrest across the world, really, in 1968. I think of images that I've seen from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968 with riots where people came from all corners of the United States. But there, the police, you know, if they were especially armed, maybe had a rifle. Most only had a baton. Some had a helmet. How has that image of the police officer changed in the last 52 years? And what has that done to the police's role and ability to de-escalate a situation, whether it be in a riot situation or whether it be in an instance of civil disobedience where outrage is merited?
Well, the police have become highly militarized with high-grade weaponry, high-grade vehicles, Black Hawk helicopters, the whole kind of dystopian movie view of how you exercise social control. Obviously, that doesn't enhance understanding and communication with the neighborhood. The fact of the matter is, put this as bluntly as I can, because it's true, in most cities, police departments in poor neighborhoods are and have been for some time armies of occupation.
Sure. Now, with regards to crowd control, how much of a militarized police serves to escalate rather than de-escalate an otherwise peaceful protest?
When you're facing someone who looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger and RoboCop, that is intimidating. The use of force in crowd control is a serious problem. It's a bad way to handle it. As far as most police departments are concerned, it's the only thing they can really figure out, even though there are other ways of de-escalating situations. The obvious way, for example, with some of the demonstrations going on now and what we expect in cities with good police departments, is that they will provide and secure an acceptable, public, easily accessed place for demonstrations to occur, not try to repress them. It poses no threat to anyone, and you can have a very low police presence there that doesn't intimidate people. And you can still have the exercise of protest without it endangering anyone. And that has worked fairly well. It's an idea some other departments might try.
A lot of protesters are saying, we're not going to reform our way out of this. There have been police oversight commissions. There have been, you know, we mentioned 1968. There were national commissions set up then. Short of, you know, a hard reset, what can be done about just frequent instances of you know, violence that are levied against civilians?
Well, there are a lot of things. The one thing that can't be done is to expect the police to reform themselves. That will not happen, and that can't happen. We can move to civilian control of police. We can move to prosecutors other than elected district attorneys, who are special prosecutors who investigate police and bring charges against police. We can move to a new standard of how we fund and deal with the police. I've seen signs, and I'm sure you have too, in the demonstration suggesting the police be defunded. That sounds like a terrible idea. It's actually a good idea. Reducing federal support and reducing the reliance of municipal governments on arrests for ordinance violations and relatively minor offenses as a way of funding themselves would be a very good idea. We need to recruit much better people than we do now. We have standards that pale in comparison to Europe for police officers. The one thing that causes violence and the one thing that causes general distress in regard to of relations with the police is, in fact, police-citizen encounters. You have to reduce them, and you reduce them by reducing the scope of the criminal law. Not everything can be criminal.
And a lot of people have talked about how easy it is to call 911 for the slightest of discomforts.
And indeed they do. And local governments will pass ordinances and local laws to cover those discomforts. You have laws in some municipalities against changing your oil on a public street because it offends homeowners. Well, that's too bad. You shouldn't be writing a ticket for that.
Especially if it might result in a fatal encounter.
Right, which it may well. We have all kinds of those nuisance laws all over the place, and we have failed criminal laws. The drug war is a total abysmal, absolute failure. We might as well just accept it and get over it. We have all kinds of nuisance laws about open containers, about hanging out in public places. That's getting worse, partly because of gentrification. If I'm a businessman and I have put in a whole lot of money to put in restaurants and entertainment centers around a public park, for example, the behavior which everyone engaged in that public park now may be regarded as an annoyance. And they will pass a law outlawing it. They will pass laws to say, you can't sing in that park unless you have a license. You can't play guitar in that park unless you have a license. You can't drink in that park. All of a sudden, we have the police involved in all kinds of very minor infractions that frankly make people angry and cause encounters that should never occur.
And I think a lot of police officers would argue that they go out into the world fearing for their lives every day. So they say that, you know, why blame them for being trigger happy if there are so many guns on the streets?
Well, I think if you check the national data on job fatalities, police rank fairly low. If you check the national data on assaults, you'll find that far more teachers are assaulted than police officers.
Well, thanks so much, Professor Potter, for your time and for explaining the history of policing as we come to know it now.
Thank you.
Gary Potter is a professor emeritus at the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. He's also the author of many books and is an expert on the history of policing in America. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at wuwm.com.